from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
50 years ago this month, Pope Blessed Paul VI issued his courageous encyclical, Humanae Vitae. And it's no secret that it was met by great dissent and rejection by some even within the church. 5 decades later, the dissent remains. This week on Register Radio, we talk about the legacy, unfortunate legacy, of dissent from papal teaching with 2 experts. This is a part of the National Catholic Register's honoring of both the encyclical and the saint who wrote it. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio, and I'm joined, as usual, by Matthew Bunsen in Washington, D.C., the Register's senior editor and co-host of Register Radio. Matthew, last week we had a great conversation with Dr. Christian Brueger on this same topic, because this is a part of the Register's anniversary coverage of Humanae Vitae, and a lot of this material was printed in our July 22nd print edition. And we're welcoming Christian Brueger back this week. But first, we're going to talk to somebody else.
We are. And we're going to be joined by our regular Register contributor, Father Raymond D'Souza. Well, I know you recently wrote a piece called Humanae Vitae, Dissent is Alive and Well in the 21st Century. And I want to start with a quote from your piece. You write that when Blessed, soon-to-be Saint Paul VI, taught that what had been traditionally taught as true remained true, it was quite simply an outrage. The dissent was early, organized, and formidable. Why was there such an expectation that the Pope would actually surrender to the culture?
Well, it's hard to imagine what 1968 was like. The 1960s were a turbulent time. Leave aside moral or religious questions, there was violence in the streets all over Europe and in the United States. It was a time of social upheaval. A lot of things were being questioned. And already some very basic traditions, norms, morals around marriage and family were already being eroded. So, for example, divorce was becoming more acceptable. And everything that sometimes goes under the banner of the sexual revolution was at least present, if not dominant yet. And so there's a lot of thinking that things were going to change. Other Christian communities had changed their teaching on contraception. The thinking was that maybe the Catholics would follow suit or at least meet them halfway. And also there was, right after the Second Vatican Council, other changes that had taken place in other matters, which are not of the same nature, liturgical or some Catholic customs. So there was an expectation. And then perhaps most important is that there was actually quite an organized campaign to persuade Paul VI, who was considering the question, to make a change. There was a papal commission that was studying the issue, of which the majority thought a change should be done. That material was leaked to the press to create kind of an expectation. And many leading theologians and even pastors were encouraging this. So there was a sense that change was in the air. So that's why it came as a surprise to some. But the vehemence of the reaction, I think, says something about the cultural moment.
Yes, absolutely.
Of the late 1960s.
Well, we're in a cultural moment, I think, today that also just seems to generate dissent, especially against institutions or an objective kind of morality. And, of course, this dissent on Humanae Vitae is even more prevalent today. And I think many people, some in the pews, just don't even think about it anymore. They don't even think about the question of contraception. They just contracept. Some theologians today are denying, and they denied it back then at the time of Humanae Vitae, but they're denying that this is settled Catholic teaching. How could they do so?
I would just step back a little bit. Sometimes when it comes to sexual questions, we get a little bit, I think, overexcited. I mean, there are other things the Church teaches that are also widely ignored. I might start with Sunday Mass observance, which is actually more important. The Third Commandment is more important than the Sixth Commandment. But I would disagree a bit, Jeanette, that I think if you said, where's the culture at as a whole, certainly the culture on matters of marriage and sexuality would be further away from the teaching on contraception than 50 mm-hmm. years ago. But what has changed is that in the Christian community, broadly speaking, not just Catholic, there are now very active and, one might say deliberately, fruitful circles which embrace the teaching. And in fact, there's even something outside of Christian circles which sees the general ethos of natural methods of fertility regulation as being more fitted to the human person.
Sure.
So the situation today is actually much better than 1968 in this respect, is that there may have been people who dissented in 68, and there may have been people who accepted, but today those who accept, I think, are doing so with a much deeper formation. And you find that in various Catholic movements and some Catholic parishes. And
I'm glad you brought that up.
And also in Catholic publishing.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up.
There are lights and shadows.
Yeah, you're very right, and in our coverage, of course, of this issue has focused on dissent, but it has also focused on that aspect of it, the way it is actually being embraced, the teachings of John Paul II, which elaborated it on Humanae Vitae, and also the technologies that helped to make natural family planning more possible for those who have serious reason for using it, or who desire to conceive using natural family planning. So you're absolutely right, and we have that part of the coverage in on nationalcatholicregister.com and also in the July 22nd print edition. So yes, that point very, very well taken. I think we are in a different moment for those who are seeking. I guess what I'm thinking about is the maybe a somewhat still the academic kind of dissent that goes on and that I guess I end up hearing a lot about, and perhaps the people in the pew don't hear that much about. So that was what was foremost in my mind.
I would just put a bracket around that, because it is true that sometimes in academic circles you would find things that are, if say, more extreme. For example, in Christian biblical studies, you can find exegetes sometimes doubting the divinity of Christ.
Mm-hmm,
now,
true.
That's a problem, but it's not something, for example, that has maybe an impact on parishes per se. I would say that the culture of dissent that I wrote about that had taken root, I mean, it was a major, major challenge to the church in the 70s and 80s, but the church had a response to great, not just symbol, but reality, of which was the Catechism of the Catholic Church in 1992, so 26 years ago now. Sort of the midpoint between Humanae Vitae and today. And that's made a big difference, because when people hear things that they are not sure about or doubt the authenticity of, as opposed to 1968 or 1978 or 1988, in 2018, you can go and check and get at least a good orientation to where the church stands, and then for further research and study. So that's the culture of dissent that I wrote about that really exploded around Humanae Vitae and was a very, very grave challenge to the church. It did have a response, and that response of the catechism, now 26 years, we take it for granted a mm-hmm. bit. But before the catechism, life was considerably different, considerably different.
Yeah, well, looking at it almost also more positively, the Humanae Vitae offers this beautiful vision of Christian marriage, of human sexuality. And then we have this remarkable effort of reclaiming a proper understanding of conscience and correcting the damage done by dissent with the theology of the body under John Paul II. How significant was that contribution?
One of the challenges that Pope Paul VI faced in 1968 is that the traditional methods of making moral arguments, what we would call natural law methods, which had been dominant for several hundred years, were beginning to lose their persuasiveness, that is, the method of argument. And people were searching for something that addressed more the personal relationship with God, interpersonal relationships, and so forth. Both Cardinal Ratzinger and John Paul II in the late 60s, though they agreed with the conclusion Pope Paul VI reached, both felt that the argumentation was insufficient, that it was, if you want to say, a little too based in natural law and not so much in the invitation to life and love that we now speak about these things with. And so the response, as you point out, Matthew, theology of the body, John Paul's teaching in the early 1980s, the catechism, and subsequently in Veritatis Splendor, present something different and richer and more compelling. It is fair to say that the efforts made by Pope Paul VI were quite courageous, as everybody recognizes. He was swimming against the tide, but they perhaps were not fully adequate, or at least that was the judgment of both Cardinal Ratzinger and Cardinal Wojtyla, and they dedicated themselves in subsequent years to providing that deeper rationale. So someone today going through marriage preparation, a young college student learning about theology of the body, is getting a much richer introduction to questions of life, chastity, marriage, children, etc., than there would have been the case in the time of Humanitate.
And of course, you have direct experience with that, being on a university campus and interacting very often with college students. So we take your view of looking at the positive and how far we've come very, very seriously. And I appreciate, Father D'Souza, that perspective that you've brought to us today. Thank you.
Most welcome. I would say with college students, you also have to remember that in 1968, many of the promises of liberalized sexual morality, whether it be sex outside of marriage or sex separated from marriage, sex contracepted, many of these things were being proposed as being authentic improvements in human flourishing and happiness. Today on campus, many, many students, either through direct experience or through those close to them, have seen the rougher, darker edge of the sexual revolution.
Absolutely.
Of which exploitation, sexual abuse, pornography addiction, and many other things aside from just the lot of broken hearts and broken bodies even that we find. So in a sense, when the church presents something that's different, even if it's maybe difficult to grasp at first, there's an openness to saying, well, something might be better than what we've experienced, because what we've experienced is very painful. And that would be a key difference from 1968 to 2018.
Absolutely, and it shows the prophetic nature of this document and what Paul VI predicted, and it gives us an opportunity to help try to mend those broken hearts with the truth that Christ gave us. So absolutely, I totally agree. So thanks so much again for your time today. When we come back, we talk to Register contributor Dr. Christian Brueger about this papal teaching of Humanae Vitae and the dissent and the resistance to that dissent that we see today. This is Register Radio on EWTN.
Have you heard who's reading the Register? Why, it's Tim Staples.
The National Catholic Register gives you the world's news like no other. Only NCR has a stable of writers steeped in good Catholic theology and philosophy to give you the news with proper perspective.
For a 3-month free subscription to the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 3 months free banner, or call 1-800-421-3230.
The Trump administration rolls back the Health and Human Services contraceptive mandate.
U.S. bishops calling for the total elimination of nuclear weapons.
Pope Francis offers prayers for the victims of the California wildfires.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill banning abortions after 20 weeks.
And Pope Francis says the death penalty is contrary to the gospel.
Your link to news headlines Catholics count on at the top of the hour. Weekdays on EWTN Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, and I'm joined, as usual, by Matthew Bunsen in Washington, D.C., my co-host on Register Radio. And again this week, we are joined by Dr. E. Christian Brueger, who has been writing very regularly for the Register. He's a moral theologian, and he has been doing a wonderful series called Difficult Moral Questions for the Register. So I invite you to contact me or contact the Register to ask a difficult moral question. But the difficult moral question we're talking about today is the question of contraception, and really surrounding Humanae Vitae on this 50th anniversary of that encyclical. And Christian has written a bit about a book that is being looked at by many people across the globe. It's a book that's right now only in Italian, and it is titled the birth of an encyclical, Humanae Vitae, in light of the Vatican archive. So welcome, Christian. Welcome back. And let's start.
Thank you, Jeanette.
And let's talk about why this book that is currently in Italian is capturing so much attention.
It's a very good question. And the reason is because in early 2017, Pope Francis set up a four-man study committee to prepare for the 50th anniversary of the publication of Humanae Vitae. And he gave special access to the Vatican archives, the secret archives that have been sealed since the publication of the document back in 1968. In fact, he gave the committee access 20 years early, because mm-hmm. usually only after 70 years can people have That's access right. to these sealed documents. And when that committee was first announced, there was lots of speculation as to what they were going to be up to. Were they going to be reevaluating the content of Humanae Vitae? Were they going to propose controversial solutions to Pope Francis about perhaps amending the teaching on contraception? And so the committee finished up its work last fall. And in the meantime, the head of the commission, Monsignor Gilfredo Marengo, has written and published a book on their findings. And so it's that which is getting a lot of scuttlebutt in the Catholic That's news right. around the world. What did they find in these secret archives? Was there any smoking gun that would lead us to believe maybe we can dispense with the teaching of Humanae Vitae and all the other sorts of questions like that?
Yes, and of course, you know, you've written about this commission before. You wrote an article back in February, An Assault on Humanae Vitae Begins, and you engaged in some of that speculation of what might happen in this with this commission. Partially, it's because of this Monsignor Marengo himself. He has really been a critic of the encyclical. But what does he write here, and is it really a cause for concern in this new book?
That's very interesting. What he writes is actually encouraging to those who support the content of Humanae Vitae, even though I think what he put forward were certain revelations that he felt would allow for a kind of re-evaluation of the content of the document in light of some of the moves that are made in Amoris Laetitia. The two main findings of this book, the first is that right before the document was going to be released in May of 1968, after 5 years of preparatory work, the Pope had approved an encyclical. It wasn't called Humanae Vitae, it was called something else, De Nascendi Prolis. It was slotted to be released on the Solemnity of the Ascension, May 23rd, 1968. And then there were some critics who said, this text is too traditional. Mm-hmm. Marengo says it's full of rigorous moral doctrine, which for some in the church, nothing could be worse. Well, evidently Pope Paul took the recommendation to have it revised, and he sent it to a few of his consultors, and they went back to work on it. But what Marengo tells us is that the doctrinal section, that is the section which teaches the fundamental moral norm about the wrongfulness of contraceptive intercourse, that section he felt was fine. That is, Pope Paul VI felt was fine. What he believed needed more work was the pastoral section. And Marengo spends a lot of time on this. The Pope was most interested in the pastoral section. And what revisionist reporters from around the world are concluding is that, well, we now realize that the Pope really wasn't all that interested in the doctrinal principles being taught, in the do's and don'ts. What they were most interested in was the pastoral application, because that's what the Pope labored over. But this seems to me to be a terrible misinterpretation. What the Pope's preoccupation with the pastoral section tells me is that when he gave directions to his original drafters, he was perfectly clear about the doctrine.
Right.
I want this text to teach what the church has always taught about the truth of conjugal chastity. And I want it to be clear, and I'm not going to accept any waffling or monkey business, so make sure it's clear. And when they got the text back to him, it was clear. So he basically said to them, okay, you don't have to worry about that. But we do worry a bit about how this is going to be received. And so he had them go back to the drawing board on that. But the story that's being told is quite the opposite. The story that's being told is, well, he really wasn't all that interested in the doctrinal teaching. He really is interested in how people would receive it.
We know it was terribly. It's not surprising that some would spin it this way. We have so many conversations in the last few years over pastoral theology that is somewhat put. It's let's put it this way: pastoral theology versus doctrine. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we are hearing over and over again. So it's not surprising that this is how it's being framed when Marengo writes about this new finding of the pastoral side of Paul VI.
Yes, but to set the pastoral side against the doctrinal side is to misunderstand the whole thing. Because what pastoral care is, it is the process by which we take the truths of the faith, the doctrinal truths, and apply them to our lives. We don't revise those truths, we apply those truths, and it's a very important task. But it means that the pastoral task is always second to the doctrinal truths. They serve the doctrinal truths. So to set up a conversation as if what you have is a secondary import about the doctrine, and what's really important is about accompanying people in their struggle with the complex circumstances of daily life and all of this story, which Marengo gets into. He reads this research that he engaged in terms of many of the new concepts that are being put forward in the last few years, especially those published in Amoris Laetitia, the idea of accompaniment, the idea of progressively moving towards the fullness of the gospel, but never reaching the ideal, and of course emphasizing that people are mired in sin and we have to be realistic about what they can and can't do. He uses all of those different conceptual frameworks to conclude that Humanae Vitae is a work in process, and that process is still going on, and that the Pope was beginning that process, but he wasn't really bringing it to a conclusion, which I think is false. I think the
right.
Pope meant to bring it to a conclusion. He meant to settle the conversation over the question of whether contraception is legitimate or not.
One of those other myths that is very persistent where Humanae Vitae is concerned is this idea that it's a twofold thing, that the Pope ignored the bishops of the world when they were begging him to change the teachings of the church on contraception. But the other is that somehow then he went it alone, that he was not very consultative. But I'm struck especially by this idea that he was not very collegial, that he ignored the bishops of the church.
Yes, Marengo's account actually, and perhaps unwittingly, trashes that claim, because it tells us, and we didn't know this before, this hadn't been a public part of the Humanae Vitae story, that in October of 1967, this is a couple years after the council ended, there were 200 bishops in Rome for the first synod. Synods were restored after the Vatican, at Vatican II, and this was the first synod, and he sent a memo to them, really a survey to all 200, asking them for their reflections and suggestions on the question of birth control. Only 26 took him up on his request, and the majority of them recommended that he overturn the ancient teaching. A small handful including Carol Wojtyla, the future Pope John Paul II, and the famous Fulton J. Sheen, Bishop of Rochester, replied with strong defenses of the traditional teaching. But the fact that he initiated this very large study commission, sometimes called the Pontifical Birth Control Commission, and two, that he elicited the suggestions of 200 bishops to give him their reflections and suggestions, shows that he was very much interested in what the mind of the world's episcopate was on this matter. But of course, as the Pope, as the successor of Peter, rendering a judgment rested with him. And in the end, he was unpersuaded by the arguments of those who wanted to overturn the teaching, and he reasserted the traditional teaching.
You know, Christian, we're really out of time here, and I want to ask you a question I meant to ask you even last week, and this is just very quickly. What do we do, Catholics like me, who I haven't studied all of this, what do we do to understand this better today? How do we grasp what's going on here?
That's a great question. I would say that all Catholics should read Humanae Vitae. It's a relatively short encyclical. It's only 8,000 words compared to some of the mega documents of John Paul II and Pope Francis. It's easy to understand, and they can see that the Pope put forward there a reasoned argument as to why marriages will flourish, or at least will flourish if they respect the goods of procreation and unity. He was a pastor of souls first and foremost, and he wanted the faithful to know that if you adopt this other course of action, contracepting your intercourse, it's going to be bad for you. I don't think that most Catholics over the decades have read Humanae Vitae or have understood the reasons behind that teaching. And it's come across as a kind of legalistic command from on high, a rule by someone who's far distant from our daily lives and understanding our needs and our complexities. And so they've distanced themselves from that teaching, believing that perhaps the voices around them knew better. Understanding why he taught what he taught will help to make intelligible, understandable, this very controversial and difficult teaching of the Church. And the history has shown that those who go in the direction of rejecting the teaching don't find themselves with stronger marriages. And the community is certainly not better off for rejecting Humanae Vitae's teaching. So I think looking at the reasons, giving them a fair shot, trying to understand them, and then doing our best to put them into practice in our lives.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Christian Brueger, for your service to the Church and your service to the Register. Our listeners can find what Dr. Brueger writes on a very regular basis at ncregister.com. His latest was on Humanae Vitae, A Bitter Pill, and I encourage everyone to read that. And also to go to EWTN's library, EWTN.com, and search Humanae Vitae. There's a wonderful page that has many resources, including the encyclical itself. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us here on Register Radio on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.